Anvold Financial Group.
Hour two of your Wednesday edition of Justice and Drew is underway. Very much looking forward to reconnecting with our good friend of the show, David Gartenstein Ross, in about a half an hour from now. He'll join us around 7:35 this morning, but we do have one more item to get to in Sam's top five for a Wednesday.
Number five.
Gasoline prices are set to go down at the pump from Fox Business. You can hold up on buying gasoline for a week and the price could drop by an average of 16 cents a gallon nationwide. If you fill up a Ford Expedition, that's a nifty $5.36 in savings, if you want to get specific. Gasoline prices have been sliding steadily for several weeks, and they're promising to get even cheaper as crude prices fall and the U.S. moves into the summer driving season. Near Houston and areas surrounded by refineries, the price is about $2 a gallon. But I should go fill up there. Last year at this time.
There's a problem with that idea.
That's fine. I know. It's worth the drive.
You're going to spend... Okay, go. Yes, you should. I agree.
I get excellent gas mileage. I bet it would be worth it.
You just need to fly your car... here to there, fill it up, and then fly it, and then fly it back.
Does anybody listening have a helicopter I could borrow?
Just wait, you'll hear the sound shortly. It won't be long. I don't know if there's a helipad on the roof.
Helicopters are going to descend upon our building.
Sam says she needs a helicopter ride.
Last year at this time, the average price nationally for regular gas at the pump was $2.92 a gallon. Now, following an 18% drop in crude oil prices in New York, the average sits at $2.75 at a time of year, springtime, when the price usually peaks in anticipation for more drivers on the road.
It's just an interesting note. You don't, at least for me, I don't ever notice when the gas prices are low. I always notice when the gas prices are high. It's just that moment when, because I don't even look at
for most people.
Yeah, I don't even look at the prices, and then ever like yesterday, I had to fill up yesterday on the way home, and I turned around, looked at them, and was like, $30. What? I was like, where did that go? I was like, oh, into my tank.
Well, I remember a couple of years ago, I can't remember what time of year it was, but there was like a gas station in Maple Plain or something. It was $1.75 a gallon. And I noticed that. If it's under $2, I'll notice.
If that first number is a one, I'm definitely noticing.
Yeah, then I notice, and then I definitely fill up.
I don't pay a lot of attention to gas prices. I mean, I'm like you, John. Obviously, if there's a sharp increase, it's definitely noticeable. But since I switched cars and started driving this this Mazda, it gets such fantastic gas mileage that I'm filling up much less frequently.
Yeah,
because I don't drive a ton anyway.
Right.
You know, so I'm filling up a lot less frequently, and it doesn't take much to fill up the car. It's
I can't believe Sam pinkied up you on that one.
She gave you a pinkies up.
Anytime I say anything about a thing that I do, that's her default reaction now.
You didn't even look at me.
I stubbed my toe this morning. Pinkies up.
I
didn't have to look at you. I was looking at John, and I saw him look at you, I saw his reaction.
I quietly put my pinkies up.
It's like a pinkies up bragging camp. It's like half and half.
But
it's
I wasn't like doing
my,
either of those.
I know.
My car gets excellent gas.
You just said the same damn thing like 2 minutes ago.
I just got brand new Mazda. My pinkies are so sore now.
It's all on the delivery. It's my God. It's amazing. What an amazing turn of events.
I didn't mean to take the wind out of your sales room.
I completely relate, because I don't have to fill up my Hot Wheel very often. So, for the same reason.
I mean, speak for yourselves, you guys, because I fill up my car a lot. I drive a lot. I'm commuting from Buffalo. Not pinkies up. That's please feel bad for me.
No.
Oh, my goodness gracious. I remember back when you were down, when there wasn't even like a one. I remember back in the days it was 0.99.
Yeah. I used to drive back and forth from Ocala to Gainesville when I was working in radio down there. And there was one gas station. Like, the gas prices were all usually like $1.09 or $1.11. But there was a 99-cent gas station, like right at the corner of the interstate. So, you know, that's to save, you know, 10 cents a gallon.
Yeah,
always made sure to fill up there.
Yeah, I remember the AM PM stores in the Arcos. Those were always the ones with the less expensive gas.
Yeah.
Oh, the old days. Oh, old now. Hey, remember back in the day, you just had to feed the horse.
You guys are so old.
That's right. It's a true story. All right. Associated Press starts off with this one. 7 questions on Representative Omar's tax returns answered. So not a lot in here that we haven't discussed already, but just as a preview before we get into this editorial board at the Star Tribune and Omar's credibility taking another hit. If you're not up to speed on the U.S. representative here from Minnesota, Representative Ilhan Omar, misusing campaign funds. Okay, so this is what she did wrong. The Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board said Thursday that Omar and her husband, Hersey, filed joint tax returns for 14 and 15 before they were actually married and while Omar was legally wed to another man. While some states allow for joint filing for common law marriages, Minnesota does not, and filing joint tax returns with someone who is not your legal spouse is both against the federal and state law. It's one of the...
It's a felony.
Yeah. And it's one of the things, when we get into it, the Star Tribune zeroed in on, and I was actually kind of surprised because I thought they were going to kind of go the straight-up sort of legal route, and they actually went like a little bit further, for the record, because she's Ilhan Omar has used her Muslim faith tradition argument for both marriage and divorce in the middle of this whole thing, okay? That's all fine and dandy. Okay, you can marry within your faith in the Muslim religion, right? Mm-hmm. But
then the IRS doesn't have to recognize it.
Exactly. We have laws.
Right, exactly.
And your marrying into your faith means...
Nothing.
Diddly squat when it comes to laws.
When it comes to filing your tax returns.
She's saying that, in my opinion, which you may or may not agree with. She's saying that because she wants to be able to use that as a means to push back against any individuals who would criticize her, saying that, oh, well, this is just because of my religious, yeah. my religious beliefs.
Well, that's the shield that she throws up anytime she gets criticism. Anytime that, you know, people criticize her stances, her views, her comments, whatever, the immediate response is, well, you know, as a Muslim or as a woman of color, I expect these kind of attacks, and that's her deflection,
right?
So yes, of course that's what she's going to use to try to deflect this attack, because why wouldn't she? It's worked every other time.
So state officials have ruled Omar has to repay her campaign committee $3,500, including $1,500 for payments made to an accounting firm for services related to the joint tax returns for 14 and 15. He also has to pay a $500 penalty to the state. Powerline blog has pointed this out a couple of times, just about how she was so vocal once arriving in Washington, D.C., but now she's gone silent, and the Associated Press story zeroes in on that. What has Omar said about this? Very little. In response to questions from the AP, her campaign just sent an email. All of Representative Omar's tax filings are fully compliant with all applicable tax law. And as we pointed out yesterday, that was currently... They're now compliant, right? Obviously. The campaign did not make Omar available for an interview or ask specific questions from the AP. In response to the overall campaign finance investigation, she said in a statement last week that she will comply with the state board's findings, calling for her to repay money and pay a penalty. Reading into this, and I'm definitely reading deep into this, but given just those two statements, the email from her campaign and the fact that last week she was very straight up, I'll comply with the state board findings, calling for me to repay money and pay the penalty. My reading into that, based off of how vocal she has been, and this is what Powerline has pointed out many times, is that she has been told, look, you are potentially in for a world of hurt with this. If they go, I think she knows that if this goes any further and if this goes any deeper, this whole thing is going to unravel right before her. And they're probably saying, you just need to shut up right now and just hope that this all goes away.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, she might be get, you know, she might be smartening up, getting smarter about how to handle these sorts of things. Look, she formed a crisis committee the moment that these whispers of possible immigration fraud, you know, possibly marrying her brother, all of these things popped up well back, you know, when she was, you know, just a state representative considering the run for CD5. You don't form up a crisis committee unless there's a crisis.
Right.
Right. So she knew. She knew that this was out there. She knew. So she's probably been preparing for this moment. She knew that there was an investigation into her campaign, into potential campaign finance violations. And she, I'm sure she knew that these things would come to light. So she's been ready for this. And I think that that also in part explains why she has been so quiet on it. I think she's just hoping it'll blow over. She's in an incredibly safe district. And she's in a district where there will probably be a lot of leeway given from the constituents about this particular issue. It's an incredibly safe district. Unless she's primaried, even with this hanging out over her head, she will win again. She knows this.
Right.
So she's trying to just navigate through this without any criminal penalties being considered. And that's the real sticking point, though. You know, she, assuming that all of this is accurate and all of this is true, she committed multiple felonies for multiple years, state and federal.
The only thing, and just to sort of reiterate what you were saying, because you're totally correct. The only thing that she has to worry about is the law and potentially if the DFL decides that she's damaged goods. That's all.
Yeah.
In the AP, it goes, did Omar gain something by filing jointly? They say it's hard to say. In most
situations, doesn't matter, though.
Right, it doesn't matter. In most situations, filing jointly may reduce taxes for married couples, but Eric Johnson, an attorney who practices tax law in Minnesota, said that's not always the case, and filing jointly might actually increase the tax bill for some. This would be a good question for our lawyer extraordinaire, Jeff O'Brien. She's kept, by the way.
If that, hang on. Yeah, I just want to swim in that pool for just a moment. If that's going to be the defense, because I don't see, I mean, who's asking that? Well, what did she gain? It doesn't matter if she gained or lost. It's still, she still broke the law. That's irrelevant. But if that's going to be the defense that people are going to trot out about, well, she didn't gain anything from.
Right.
I mean, you know, so what's the big deal, guys? The big deal is we're sick and tired of watching elected officials, sick and tired of watching this class of elite, you know, that you get to a certain point, and all of a sudden, the law treats you differently. You know, Hillary Clinton, the law treated her differently than it would have treated you or I. We're sick of seeing that over and over and over and over. I want to see people, and I don't care what party it is, and I don't care what position they hold. If they break the law, I want the law to be applied equally across the board.
Omar has so far kept her tax returns private. While she has called for President Donald Trump to release his tax returns, her campaign did not acknowledge the AP's request to release hers.
Aww.
Her campaign also did not answer a question about whether there might be issues with other tax returns prior to Omar's marriage to Hersey in 2018. Is Omar now in trouble with the IRS? The AP goes on to say it's not clear. One executive director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board said that the board did not look into the legality of the joint tax returns, but only whether it was appropriate to use committee funds to get a copy of them. The board never saw the returns in question. The IRS says federal privacy law prohibits it from commenting. Look, and she's also been out in the public making a lot of ridiculous statements. Mm-hmm. It's not like she's gone to Washington and is just quietly doing her job. No, she went to D.C. and then immediately started, you know, churning the cauldron and stirring the pot of liberal progressive activist nonsense from the moment that she went and arrived. So she's been putting herself out there. And I agree with you, and I echo your sentiments that she needs to be held accountable, because anybody else would be. Anybody else absolutely would be. And look, all of this points to the fact that, in my opinion, like, she shouldn't be serving. That's clear. An individual who went through all this process, who knew darn well when it came to the marriages, faith tradition, marriage, divorce via faith tradition, not doing it legally. If people around her were telling her it was okay, it doesn't matter. She made those decisions. She allegedly broke the law. And in doing so, she needs to be, you're right, absolutely held accountable, because nobody else would be able to get away with it.
No. No, of course not. If this happened to you or me or a Republican congressperson, this would be top of the news, CNN, MSNBC, across the board, and there would be calls for them to step down immediately, or, you know, at least for the House to take some action against her.
Yeah.
Has Nancy Pelosi chimed in on this?
I don't think so.
She's probably itching to, though. You know, based on all these upstart freshman congresspeople that are making her life more difficult.
Right.
She'd probably be more than happy to chime in on this.
So, you know, this is just two white guys need to undo their whiteness. Would you like to know what the editorial board of the Star Tribune had to say? You know,
I'm also curious what, our, I don't know, state attorney general.
Oh, yeah.
Might have to say about something.
Who's that again?
Keith, starts with an E. Keith something.
Oh, yeah.
He's Ellison. Ellison.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
He's busy taking out the trash. So the people weren't. U.S. Representative Ilhan Omar is back in the news again, not in a good way, writes the editorial board.
Has she ever been in the news in a good way?
I don't. Yeah, right. Seriously. Has Ilhan Omar ever just tweeted out like an opinion on a movie? Right? Has that ever, you know, I saw that Dog's Way Home. It was really good. Like, is that ever, she ever just tweeted out something nice? You know, weather's good today.
I can pull up her Twitter feed here.
Yeah, I'm just curious. Maybe she has. I don't know. I have no idea. Now, the Star Tribune says, in October of 2018, they penned an editorial. They called on Omar to more fully explain her travel and other expenses. We noted that the allegations suggest a pattern of carelessness and or self-dealing with legally restricted funds. Neither conclusion inspires the confidence voters deserve to have in someone they send to the U.S. House to represent them. That's what they wrote back in October of 2018. It is even more disturbing, therefore, to learn that among the board's latest findings was a troubling discovery that is far beyond its jurisdiction, but worthy of greater scrutiny nonetheless. Omar, 2 years running, filed joint tax returns with the man she was living with but not legally married to. Complicating matters further, she was legally married to another man at the time. It is against the law in Minnesota to file jointly unless one filer is legally married to the other. Last year, Omar told the Star Tribune that she had married her partner, doing that thing with my fingers, in her faith, and had earlier divorced her first husband, also with my fingers, in her faith. That's fine for religious purposes. But not for tax purposes. Only civil marriages qualify. It's not known whether she benefited materially by filing jointly. That is something that the voters, who are obliged to follow tax laws, no matter how painful, are entitled to know. It's not too much to expect that a lawmaker would check with a tax attorney on rather complicated marital status before filing. Then they say, Omar's no stranger to controversy. As a new House member, she collected $25 in speaking fees, $2,000 from Normandale Community College, $500 from Inverhills Community College for appearances made shortly after she took office. Representative Steve Draskowski, who publicly noted the state law prohibits legislators from collecting such fees from the groups, have business before the legislature made that public. Omar returned the money. In his latest complaint, he said it's very clear there are huge ethical problems with Representative Omar. He told an editorial writer, adding that the House should consider an ethics investigation. Yeah, bring on the ethics investigation. If this pattern continues, says the Star Tribune, further investigation may be necessary. Maybe they should do some investigative work. I think the Star Tribune, they got stuff to do, you know?
It's a thing journalists are supposed to do.
They should do that. Omar could have avoided nearly every, and this is the part that I thought they actually nailed. Omar could have avoided nearly every infraction by taking simple measures in advance to determine whether her actions would pass legal muster. In its findings, the board noted that the Minnesota House research staff did explain that generally when they discuss whether a member can accept something of value, for example, travel and lodging reimbursement, they discuss whether it would violate a gift prohibition, but do not advise. Rather, they commonly refer board members to the board. The Omar committee did not contact board staff, and the appropriateness of using committee funds for travel reviewed in this investigation.
Yeah. Yeah, she didn't bother.
Nope.
She didn't bother because she comes from a mindset where, you know, if you're on the right side of things, then there is no accountability. Everything you do is justified. And you know, going back to these tax returns, she probably never thought this would there was any possibility this would ever even come up.
651-989-5855. That's the phone number if you want to call and comment. You can always, of course, use the hashtag TCNT on Twitter. Coming up, we do have some audio from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Oh, man. You want to hear this audio.
Yeah, she's demanding a lot of things. We're also going to be talking with David Gartenstein-Ross coming up just after the bottom of the hour. Eight Americans were quietly flown home from a former ISIS caliphate in Syria. We'll talk about those individuals and the differences in how the Trump administration is handling them. And also the censorship by mob rule that's going on within YouTube. Right around 8 o'clock. We're going to undo some whiteness. Talk a little.
We're going to try.
Seattle yoga teacher.
We're going to attempt to undo each other's whiteness. Do you undo your own, or can you undo other people's?
This yoga teacher is trying to help people undo other people's. Man, I got a lot of whiteness. I don't know. If you can undo it.
There's an editorial in the Star Tribune that we'll get to. I don't want to wipe out on this now, but it's a counterpoint to the Minneapolis city staff dividing up their meetings based off of individuals' race. So this is a group that wants to defend why that segregating would be a good idea. I feel like these problems, and this is the obvious, but not for the obvious reason. I feel like these problems would be solved. Certainly by not segregating, getting everybody together in the same room, but then just allowing people to go and like share their lives with everybody else. So like my point is, like, I have a hard enough time being me as it is. Like, I already hate me for a whole bunch of reasons. Right? I don't need to add my whiteness into the mix. I mean, I have a hard enough time just looking, that's me in the mirror, you know, this kind of thing.
Talk about something you can't do anything about.
Right. So I just feel like if you had a chance to talk to these individuals who feel like, you know, people like us, like you, Drew, and Sam, need to look at your whiteness and undo it, I feel like if they just got to know us a little bit, they'd be like, geez, whatever. They got a whole batch of other problems beyond this whole race issue.
Well, and that's kind of what it comes down to for everybody, right?
Right.
I mean, who doesn't?
Exactly.
Who doesn't have issues? Who doesn't have insecurities? Who doesn't have things that they deal with, whether it's appearance or, you know, what they... It could be anything. I don't know. I mean, everybody's got their bag.
Right? Identity politics sucks.
Yeah, it's awful.
It's horrible.
It's awful and terrible and you know, it's not like the right has been, you know, innocent in using it as well. I mean, it's an easy thing for people
sure.
to use to divide them against
sure.
one another.
Absolutely.
You know, and we should be better than this. It's 2019. We should be much better and much farther along than we are on this.
We were getting better.
We were getting better.
Well, you know, I guess the way these things cycle out. Like maybe our kids will come back around. Maybe our kids and our kids' kids.
Well, and that's what I worry about, though. Right. You know, and I worry about the impact, the message that this sends to kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you got a young white kid that's, you know, getting into middle school or early high school, and like all they hear from all their woke teachers and friends and everybody they interact with is, you know, white people bad, white people bad, white people bad. I mean, that stuff sinks in.
And it's
it affects people.
And it's not. And it's one thing. And I know we have other things to cover. But since we're here, because I was just talking about this yesterday, you're right. That wokeness that they're getting from the adults around them is causing problems. The thing that I'm alarmed by is the impact of social media, because I was having a conversation with Melinda, and we were talking about discussions that are had with, you know, with my children and my, you know, my and Kyle, my younger one, and these topics that he ends up having conversations about, that there's no way to know whether or not he wouldn't be having these conversations if it wasn't for social media. However, I know that he's having conversations with friends at school that I'm convinced, one, they don't need to be talking about at their age. right? They just don't need to be having these conversations. They don't need to worry about these things at their age. But two, I'm also convinced that a lot of this is stemming from social media and young kids who are using social media and on social media, and they're getting exposure to a lot of these adult issues. And I'm not, and it's politics, but it's also politics and it's sex and it's pop culture. Like, we got exposed to that at a young age through the adults around us and somewhat through the music that we listened to. But there wasn't another venue that we spent a lot of time in where there was all this information being thrown at us mm-hmm. at a really young age. And now the kids, it's so hard to have that wall there anymore.
Yeah.
They don't need to worry. I didn't worry about politics for a long time
right.
until I got older. And there's kids that are having discussions about this now. And no, man, be a kid. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the negative side effects of what social media has done.
We left off in the last segment talking about the Star Tribune editorial actually coming out and being, you know, quite critical of Ilhan Omar. It surprised us both. Joining us now, friend of the show, Representative Nick Zerwas. Good morning, sir.
Thank you. How are you doing this morning?
We're doing fantastic. It's great to hear from you.
Good, good. Good to see you guys. So it's interesting because I think the press doesn't know what to do. I think the story came out on Thursday. I talked to several members of the press, and I tried to point out the issue with the filing of the tax returns. And I had a lot of people go, yeah, well, you know, it's probably not really.
You know.
and this is not the story they want to cover. And so I think the Pioneer or the Star Tribune is coming out with an editorial. I found it interesting that they, I think in the first or second paragraph, quick remind the readers, hey, we brought this up before.
Yeah, yeah. Third paragraph, they talked about their October 18th editorial.
We brought this up before. There's questions that need to be answered. What they also point out is, yeah, you said there was questions that need to be answered. She basically told you to go take a long walk. Didn't answer any of the questions. She got elected to the United States Congress, and you never paid attention to it again.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
Nick, we're super short on time, but because we got a guest coming up. But just real quick, do you think that this goes further? Do you think Ilhan Omar is legitimately in trouble, and then further investigations are going to yield more negativity aimed at her?
It depends if the press actually gets serious about asking questions. Did she knowingly file tax returns jointly with someone she wasn't married to or married to someone else? Is that a yes or no? That's a yes or no question. Did she actually do that? The campaign finance report said it happened. Did she do it? Is it just for those 2 years or is it other years? Some believe it may be for several other years. And then is there any intellectual curiosity and to some of the other claims that have arisen in her divorce filing from 2 years ago? She had a divorce proceeding in which the husband didn't need to respond because she said that from her first legal marriage he had left the country and she hadn't been in contact with him in years, except on her social media accounts, including Instagram. There's photos of her and that man together as soon as just a few months earlier. Mm-hmm. So it is likely that she signed her name and sworn off another legal filing in which she told a provable lie. Is there any interest from the press to dig into facts like that and truly try to get to the bottom of this bizarre situation with a woman, a first-time member of Congress on the House Foreign Intelligence Committee that has direct involvement in our nation's Foreign policy.
Nick, we got to stop you there because we're super short on time, buddy. We got a guest coming up, but we appreciate you calling in. Is he in for the roundtable on Friday?
Nick, will we see you on Friday?
Yes, sir.
All right, we'll talk to you then. Take care, buddy. Thanks for calling in.
CEO of Valens Global, counterterrorism expert David Gartenstein-Ross will join us next. We have some American ISIS members coming home. We'll get David's thoughts on that. And then the latest move by the social networking companies to purge their users of what they believe is hateful conduct.
11:30.
Welcome back. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, your Wednesday edition of Justice and Drew continues on. If you want to take part in the program, it's real easy. You can use the hashtag TCNT on Twitter, and we check that all the time. Keep an eye out for our friends and fans of the show. Or you can give us a call, 651-989-5855 or #250 on any mobile device and just say TCNT.
Been far too long since we've had him on. CEO of Valens Global, valensglobal.com, David Gartenstein-Ross. Good morning, sir. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning, John Justice and Drew Lee. Great to join you.
Let's get right into it. Got a couple of different issues we want to talk to you about today. First off, we'll start off with ISIS and terrorism. There's an article out of the New Yorker. Curious to get your thoughts on. America's ISIS members are coming home. June 5th, 8 Americans were flown home from the former ISIS caliphate in Syria. So far, the handling of the returnees has been far different from what Donald Trump had promised during the presidential campaign. The Justice Department has opted to try the ISIS returnees in the U.S. courts and even release or resettle them, as opposed to what Trump had initially said in 2016 of using Guantanamo Bay and loading it up with bad dudes. And those were his words. So curious to get your thoughts on this return of these eight Americans and whether or not we're doing the right thing with them.
I think we are, and I don't think this is necessarily a retreat from what Trump had said previously about loading Gitmo up with bad dudes. When we think about the worst of the worst, it's even though many of the Americans who went over are quite bad, they're not the worst of the worst. They're not among the most dangerous. The reason why, there's multiple reasons why I think that using Gitmo to deal with them would be a bad move. But, you know, the most basic one is it's really expensive to hold people in Gitmo. I mean, the cost per detainee or prisoner is orders of magnitude higher than what it is in the United States. The second reason I think this is the right call is because we have a U.S. justice system that is well equipped to deal with these returnees.
Is there anything, before we move on to talking social networking with you, is there anything with regard to terrorism or ISIS that hasn't been covered as of late? You know, we often do some digging before we have you on to look for possible topics that are in your wheelhouse. And I wasn't seeing a lot of coverage beyond this story in regards to ISIS. So is there anything worth mentioning at this point?
Well, the big thing I'm following is the situation with Iran actively working to reshape the regional order. You just had one of the most serious incidents involving an Iranian proxy. So for some time, for months upon months, Iranian-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen have been shooting a variety of missiles and also using drones to attack into Saudi Arabia, including attacking Saudi airports. You actually just had an incident where, for the first time, a drone that was launched by the Houthi missiles got past Saudi air defenses and actually hit the waiting area in an airport. 19 people were injured, but that's a major incident. When you look at other things over the course of the past, you know, several weeks to a month involving Iran, including sabotage of oil tankers off of UAE, which has been blamed on Iran, and the warnings coming from American military officials that they believe that Iran might put out the green light to some of the groups associated with it to attack Americans, we're seeing a significant regional escalation.
Switching gears, let's talk a little social media, and we'll start off with a question. We've got a couple articles here. There's one, there was a Washington Post study done. Twitter is eroding your intelligence, according to the study. Also, been a lot of talk about the censorship in the article here. Censorship by mob rule is awful. Start off with this question. These tech companies, Twitter, YouTube, and the like, when they started, they set up their own guidelines, and we all have a process of which we can go in and make these tech companies aware of material that may or not be inappropriate, then they go and take action. They've taken that certainly many steps further in searching out what they believe is questionable content and then sort of applying their own rules, which they're entitled to do. The question that I have starting off is, are these tech companies going to end up being their own downfall? Wouldn't it be better if they just stuck and adhered to their original rules that seemed, for the most part, to be working? It seems as if they're drawing a lot of undue attention to themselves by taking their own action.
I think that sticking with their original rules would have been a non-starter. And let me preface this with, this actually isn't a disagreement with you.
Okay.
The reason I think it would have been a non-starter is because they didn't anticipate the way that their platforms could be used either, you know, to kill, to, you know, publicize grisly images of murders, or to encourage people to go to something like ISIS's caliphate, where they would, you know, commit a wide variety of war crimes. Those really were not anticipated when these companies were stood up, where they just saw it as a way of connecting people. And, you know, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube didn't really think of the downside of, or certainly not as much as they could have, of communication on their platforms. Generally, our principles of free speech in the United States are built around the idea that over time, bad speech will be crowded out by good speech. Good ideas will win out over bad ideas. And I believe that that's largely correct over time. And thus you want to err on the side of not censoring speech. But when you get into things like the way ISIS was using the platform and the way some others have used the platform, you know, the way in which, for example, the New Zealand mosque shooting was taken from a GoPro with video that basically looked like a first-person shooter video game, but real people are dying. All of that is creates problems where they have to be more restrictive on the platform than they'd originally anticipated. Now, that being said, this is where we get into the problem and where I think you have a significant point slash where we're on the same page, that ultimately we're in a communication environment where there can be pushes, and one of the people who the kind of the villain of the piece that you talk about, the piece that appeared in Washington Examiner, Carlos Maza, is actually someone who I've known since he was an undergraduate student. He and I are both have some affiliations with Wake Forest University's debate team. As I think you know, one of my charms is I tend not to, you know, attack people who I know. But at the same time, I strongly disagree with them. I think that this impulse to try to deplatform people, to pull their sponsorship from them, et cetera, when you disagree with them, in some cases, I think that it is a reasonable thing to do. But I think you have to absolutely be sparing, and it can't be used as a tool just to crowd out voices that you dislike, which is the criticism that is being aimed. The problem, I think that there's multiple problems, but one of which is these platforms, you know, Twitter and much more so Facebook, are becoming the 21st century version of the public sphere, which means that people really see whether or not they are able to have a voice on Facebook, whether they're able to use ads on Facebook or YouTube or Twitter. Well, sorry, not so much Twitter, because that it has a different model, but Facebook or YouTube. These are significant issues to them. Livelihoods can depend on it. The ability to be heard in the public sphere can depend upon it. And so there's much more, and across party lines, there's much more of a view than there ever was before to nationalize these platforms. I think that in this way, they absolutely are their own enemies, because they've become so big, and their standards are somewhat nebulous. One final thing I'll say, I actually just completed You know, full disclosure, I'm in the process of completing a study for Facebook, which is looking at their standards that pertain to dangerous organizations. I can say that, you know, a lot of thought has gone into that, gone into the standards that they promulgated there and elsewhere. And, you know, it's really hard when you have a global user base of 2.4 billion, you're going to have, you know, wildly conflicting standards of speech from one region to another, or in the United States, even within the country, with kind of very deep divisions and, you know, people who feel that views that are coming from the other side should be either deplatformed or defunded, accusations of bias all around. All of this makes them their own worst enemies. And as I said, in fairness, it's in a situation in which, you know, it's really hard not to end up angering a lot of people when you are where they are.
You make a very fair and good point in talking about how, you know, these platforms have become sort of, you know, this generation's, this century's version of the public square. But the big difference is, you know, the public square, you know, when you walked into the public square, you didn't have algorithms pushing certain soapboxes to you and not, you know, and sort of hiding other ones. And that, to me, I think is where these platforms get in trouble, is with all of the algorithms. And, you know, I was listening to another show not long ago talking about conspiracy theories and how these algorithms are in a large part, you know, responsible for fomenting a lot of these conspiracy theories. You may go look up a video on, you know, it's like let's look at vaccination as an example. You know, you're a new parent and your child is due to get some vaccinations. So what do? You hop on the internet and you Google, you know, information about vaccinations. And it, you know, you're not just a couple clicks away from some hysterical, you know, anti-vax YouTube video or blog post filled with misinformation or, you know, or outright lies that are designed to scare you into not vaccinating your kids. So I guess my question for you, you kind of addressed the main point of why I wanted to bring you on, which is this deplatforming effort made that we're seeing, you know, a lot of conservatives be demonetized or pushed off the platforms because of. What do you think, specifically YouTube, or, you know, these social media channels in general, what do you think they should do with this increased push by political organizations or activists to deplatform voices and opinions that they disagree with?
Well, there's what they should do, and then there's what should be done in the political sphere. My view is that they just need to be more resilient in the face of calls. On the one hand, these companies have shown that they can accept to a degree public criticism, right? That they understand they're going to make a lot of people unhappy. At least they've come to understand it over time, and to, you know, be at least somewhat okay about it. On the other hand, they tend to, they tend to fall on sort of the woke side of the political spectrum. And so, tend to be much more hypersensitive to calls from the left or calls that, are able to raise some sort of specter of, you know, intersectional harm in terms of pulling content down. And, I think that ends up with a situation where they don't pull content down or deplatform or demonetize in any sort of even-handed way. Like, if you're to look at what they do, it's, there seems to be a worldview, not a fully censorious one, but there seems to be a worldview behind it. Now, let me point out actually something interesting, though, in your comment, Andrew, because there actually are two opposing threads even in what you said, where you end by asking about deplatforming and demonetizing, and we both agree that that's a problem, but you actually began with an argument for deplatforming or demonetizing, right? What you talked about is anti-vaxxers, and you and I are on the same page about that entire argument against vaccines. I consider it to basically be a conspiracy theory, but the flip side is, you know, the argument for why it should be there a click away is a neutral one, which is that the algorithm is giving you, things that come up and are widely read on that topic. So the argument would be that actually is neutrality. My only point is that even the way the question was framed, interestingly points to some of the difficulties for these companies. And this is by no means a full-throated defense of these companies. I actually would come down very critically of, certainly of Facebook. I think that we can understand, even from the way the question is framed, the difficulties that are at play in making the decisions that they do.
CEO of Valens Global, valensglobal.com, David Gartensteiner, we always enjoy our time talking with you, and thanks for giving us some this morning, sir.
Thank you, gentlemen. Great joining you again.
Take care. We'll talk to you soon.
Coming up, we will have the audio of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez demanding higher pay. It's really ridiculous. Then we're going to talk about undoing whiteness, and we'll just be honest, we're going to mock it like a lot.
Wait, hold on. You didn't consult me on this.
I'm going to mock it.
I might take it very, very seriously.
Okay, I'm not going to.
I'm going to, within the next segment, undo all of my whiteness.
I've got a bunch of problems, and there's very few of them. I mean,